Welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Our topic today is storytelling. Joining us today are Dr. Ashley Allen, Dr. Ryan Anderson, Dr. Marianne Jacobs, and Dr. Roger Ladd. Your host for 30 Brave Minutes is Dr. Jeff Frederick, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences.
Dr. Marianne Jacobs is an associate professor and chair of American Indian Studies Department. She teaches courses in American Indian Studies, American Indian Identity, and Education and Cultural Competency. Dr. Jacobs was previously the director of American Indian Studies at Cal State University, Long Beach, and assistant professor of social work at San Diego State University. She completed her doctorate in social service admin at the University of Chicago in 2005. Dr. Jacobs is the co-editor of one book and the author of several peer-reviewed articles, chapters, essays, and reports dealing with historical trauma, foster care, racial identity, Chicago's American Indian community, American Indian lesbian and gays, child welfare policies for indigenous children, and decolonizing methods. Welcome, Marianne.
Thank you.
Marianne, tell us about some of the different storytelling traditions and practices in Native communities.
For a long time, researchers would say that American Indian communities were oral. An oral tradition was the way that all knowledge was transmitted. But now we have more information about how Native people wrote down things. And of course, it didn't look like the Roman numeric alphabet that we are used to using for literature, but we do have more understanding of the ways in which things were written down in history for Native people prior to contact with Europeans, and then post that as well. But storytelling has been a part of all sorts of heritage within Native communities. So it was entertainment, it was ceremony, it was spirituality. Storytelling was a way to instruct someone, it was a way to tease someone, it was a way to get somebody back into the social norms within the community who had overstepped. Storytelling was just a way of life. You ask an elder a question, and instead of answering that question, they will reply in a story.
That's really cool. What makes a story more likely to survive through multiple generations as opposed to sort of fade away?
Well, it was the importance of the story. These stories were, how did our people come into being? For what purpose did God make us? These stories were why we eat this berry and not that one. They were very intimately related to the individual as well as to the group, okay? And it gave you a larger understanding of who you were and why you were important, why your group was important. And it also transmitted to you all the knowledge of the land that you were living on. I was told once by a guy who does storytelling, and he was saying that in Native communities, you try to tell the story as much like the person who told you that story, so that it's passed down in as original form as you can possibly get it. Even though there are different versions of stories, and different tellers will add more things or leave certain things out, you had a responsibility to tell the story as good as you could, in the same way that the original storyteller told you. So that and all sorts of things like that, the way to make a particular type of shirt or the way to make a certain regalia, it was passed down to you is a certain way, and this is the way our colors should lay, and this is the fold that it should take. And so that was the same type of attention and detail that storytelling had.
Ashley Allen is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at UNCP. She earned her BA from Wake Forest and her PhD in social psychology from Duke University. Before coming here, Dr. Allen taught at the University of North Florida. Her research areas include self and identity concepts such as self-compassion and self-presentation, In addition to social psychology courses, Dr. Allen teaches personality and leadership courses. The assistant editor of the journal Mindfulness, Dr. Allen also has a love for statistics. Now, there's a story. And teaches the research statistics courses in the psychology department. Ashley, what is it about the human condition that leads us to create our own personal stories?
Well, so sort of as we've been talking, I have been thinking about this idea that people are storytellers by nature. And across all cultures, we see this element of storytelling. So it sort of makes sense that we would take storytelling and apply it to our personal lives and our personal life narratives. So there's research suggesting that at the age of 3, kids sort of start to look back on past events and formulate them in these forms of stories. And that really when we start integrating our personal narratives and working that out is during this time of adolescence, emerging adulthood. It's one of the things that I think our college students here are engaging in a lot, is trying to figure out what is their personal life narrative and what, how are they integrating everything that's happening to them in their lives and forming that into a coherent story that makes sense and has brought them to who they are today. So I guess in that way, we're all working on our own personal narratives all the time, and they're constantly changing and evolving, and they're factoring in all the positive things that are happening, all the negative things that are happening, but in a way that makes sense to us and is also affected by elements of us. So the fact that some of us are maybe more optimistic probably affects our stories. The sense of identity that we have affects our stories. And then in any given transmission of a story, when you're telling your story to somebody, the audience member matters. So there's lots of different things, I guess, that would impact what our personal life narratives look like.
You mentioned positive and negative.
Right.
Do we incorporate positive or negative effects, more events, more effectively into our personal narratives? Which seem to register more deeply?
Well, I think we integrate both into our personal narratives. The research shows, actually, that negative life events and just these negative things that happen to us require more integration. So they just require more reflection. I mean, you think about it, if something goes wrong in your life, your first question is why? Like, what happened? What made this occur? And that requires you to reflect on it, to figure out a reason, to communicate meaning for that. Whereas when something great happens, we don't reflect on it as much. We sit there and say, that was wonderful. But we're not asking ourselves why. Well, we're wonderful, I guess, right? So we can just move on. There's even some research that suggests that if you pause and reflect on positive events too much, it makes them less positive, which is kind of interesting, right?
Over-reflection.
Yeah, so it's sort of like you're taking away that positive affect by thinking about it and kind of making it more intellectual.
Well, in thinking about how stories can evolve over time, what are the markers or cues that cause us to edit or enlarge the size of the fish that we caught or change the story?
Well, so when I look at like autobiographical research, according to psychologists and by these biographies that we're telling about ourselves, they're not the purpose of them, I guess, is not to be exactly truthful. Right? The purpose of them is to communicate meaning, to have this cohesion. And sometimes we tell them, like, to be funny, etc. But what we remember about our past is very, very much so influenced by, I guess, how important it is to us, etc. So there's so many things that we forget that just weren't meaningful. And our stories change, of course, over time. So as new events happen, or as we take on new positions, or as we form new relationships, things that might not have been central to our stories in the past become central. And things that were central to our stories in the past maybe are no longer central. So those sorts of things happening can impact, I guess, what our stories develop and look like over time. But in terms of the positive and negative stuff, things that I really like about that, there's a lot of research out there about having, I think it's called a redemptive narrative for your life story, or a contaminated narrative for your life story. So the redemptive one is you take the negative events that have happened and you sort of find what's the positive silver lining in them, like what's that positive meaning that I've developed out of that. And then the contaminated ones, I mean, as it suggests, you sort of see something that's really positive and it goes downhill over time and never quite comes back. And you can see that in how adolescents and emerging adults, our college students, how they tell their personal life narratives. So some of them have more redemptive life stories and some of them have more contaminated life stories.
Fascinating. Roger Ladd is a professor in the Department of English, Theater, and Foreign Languages and teaches courses in both British and world literature, particularly medieval and early modern literature. He also teaches composition in other courses and directs the graduate program in English Ed. He's the author of one book, Anti-Mercantilism in the Late Medieval English Literature, and a number of essays, including one group of articles on the King Arthur story in the children's magazine Calliope. He also finds that many medieval narratives, especially Beowulf, still make great campfire stories for Cub Scouts. Roger, welcome.
Thank you.
What would you say are the hallmarks of the British storytelling tradition?
Well, it doesn't really exist in isolation. Northern European culture, in particularly the early Middle Ages, the languages are interintelligible. And so you get a story like Beowulf, which is about Danish people. We get texts like, there's a really interesting poetic translation of Genesis that is actually an adaptation from continental Old Saxon in part, and you can tell because the lines are longer, the poetic structure is different. And then Christian culture is Latin culture, and that's shared throughout Western Europe, or what they used to call Christendom. And so you'll have things like the riddle, which is a very popular monastic form in Latin and finds its way into English in one Anglo-Saxon manuscript. And the English ones are maybe a little bit dirtier than some of the Latin ones are. Not appropriate for a podcast, but...
So some of my students are British?
Apparently. When you get into the later British tradition, there's a lot more continuity with French. A number of really influential early French texts, like the Song of Roland or the work of Marie de France, are actually written in Britain. And so Britishness as a concept is complicated. They tend to be interreferential with other texts. Originality doesn't become a literary value until well after the period that I study. And so nobody's worrying about it. They're telling, their version of a story that's been told before. One of my favorites is a long narrative poem from the 14th century called Sir Orfeo, which is a reinterpretation of the classical Orpheus and Eurydice story as a Breton lay. So it's adapting a Greek form into a French form in English.
It's great.
Which is sort of quintessentially medieval and British. The sort of a little bit of everything all put into a blender, and what pops out is probably the best fairy story in Middle English.
Talk a little bit about Chaucer. Why do those stories fit so prominently into the way in which we start to understand human nature and the similarities and differences?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting in Chaucer as a storyteller is that he's very interested in different kinds of stories. And so when he puts together his story collection, he has a different approach from anybody before him who's done that. I mean, rough contemporaries of him like Boccaccio or his acquaintance John Gower write large story collections where the stories are relatively similar. Gower's vary more than Boccaccio's. They both tend to go back and forth between higher and lower culture. Some of Boccaccio's are very low. And some are very high, and some of them are in common. The Clerk's Tale from the Canterbury Tales is adapted from Boccaccio. And there are a number of tales in common with Gower as well. But Chaucer varies more. He isn't trying to make things as consistent, and he's trying to experiment, I think, with just about every narrative form that's really in play in a broader European culture in his era. So he's got allegories, he's got dirty jokes, he's got romances with heroism, he's got anthologies of stories of dead people, which are spectacularly dull. The Monk's Tale is so dull that somebody almost falls off his horse by nodding off in the pilgrimage. And because of that variety, it lets him experiment with all of the different possibilities. And some of them have proven to have real staying power. The Shipman's Tale, which is one of the fabliaux or humorous stories, was collected in the 1960s as a joke orally in South Carolina. The tale had circulated orally separately from Chaucer, or had gone oral from somebody reading Chaucer and thinking this would make a great joke, and was collected by an academic and realized, oh my goodness, that's the Shipman's Tale.
Stories have long legs, don't they?
They do, and they move around.
Great. Ryan Anderson's desk has long featured a post-it on which he has written, "Tell a good story." That charge guides both his teaching and scholarship. As an associate professor of history, he helps students sort through how Americans thought about and shaped the histories of childhood and youth, masculinity, and popular culture since the late 19th century. As a scholar, he writes and speaks about how late 19th and early 20th century Americans used stories to negotiate what the creation of modern America meant. He has published on memorization, memorialization, and college life, boys, reading habits, and education, and American Indian kinship and federal aid during the Great Depression. His first book, Frank Merriwell and the Fiction of All-American Boyhood, was released last year by the University of Arkansas Press. It considers how turn-of-the-century children worked with and against adults while creating a new genre of popular fiction, the schoolboy sports story, which defined boyhood in modern America. At the moment, the good stories he's most engaged with include a new project examining the working lives of young caddies at the Pinehurst Golf Resort, where, it should be noted, Ryan is a virtual scratch golfer, and reading and discussing the comic book series Bone with his son Max. Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, good to be here.
Talk about how men and women use story differently. Do they collect them differently? Do they tell them differently?
Well, you know, I think that we tend to think that men and women have very different perspectives when it comes to the stories they tell and why they tell them. I tend to think that what we think to be differences really tend to say more about us than about the people involved. You know, I think that men and women tell different stories for very similar reasons. And that is, you know, they want to understand who they are and where they are and when they are. For a long time, you know, I think historians tended to assume that what men and women were reading, particularly in the late 19th and early 20th century, the time period that I focus on, were drastically different. That there was a woman's reading that sort of took its head from Louisa May Alcott's description of it as kind of scribblings of women, sort of, you know, light romances and poetry and that kind of thing. And that there was then men's reading, and that men's reading sort of followed, you know, romantic, almost like Ivanhoe-esque tales, and then the hard sciences and, you know, political treatises of the time. But, you know, a lot of, you know, the more interesting scholarship to come out in the last 10, 15 years has suggested that when you actually look at how people read and what they talked about, that these sorts of boundaries were very blurry. You know, I think about somebody like Christine Stansel, who, you know, looks at groups like a literary club in Greenwich Village, made up of bohemians at the turn of the 20th century, called Heterodoxy, which, from outside appearances, looks like educated, cutting-edge women in a woman's book club. But they're reading stuff that women shouldn't be reading, right? They're reading science, they're reading politics, and they're discussing these things. So, you know, are they women reading, or are they thinkers reading? You know, it's kind of hard to determine that, you know, and even in, you know, my most recent work, you know, I looked at a kid's story, but one of the things I was surprised to find was really how many adults read kids' books, you know, and, you know, some of these sort of divisions we have, you know, that women and men use stories or read stories for certain reasons, I think are things that current researchers really question, you know, and that probably gives us a little more insight than we used to have into how people actually lived, how people actually thought, what was important to them. I mean, that's what stories ultimately are. They tell us what's important to people.
Part of the rites of passages that seem in a society to take us from boyhood to manhood or from being a girl to being recognized as a woman are collecting certain sets of experiences and then turning them into stories. Yeah. Is that changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's changed about it is who drives that process. You know, particularly in pre-Civil War, American Civil War literature, there's usually an adult. The adult, it's very didactic. It's the adult teaching the kid a lesson. You take somebody like Joseph Abbott's series of books, The Rollo Adventures. And Rollo is, to be quite honest, insufferable as a little kid. I mean, he is a real pain, you know. The very first book, Rollo at Work, you meet Rollo at 5, and he tells his father, "Father, I would like to make money." And his father says, "Well, then you will have to work hard for money," and then sets Rollo to picking rocks out of the garden. And Rollo finds this boring, and Rollo quits. So for dinner that night, everybody in the family has beefsteak, while Rollo must eat only bread and butter. You know, so this, and of course, he eventually learns, well, if I want money, I must work at this job no matter how little I like it. By the time we get to the 20th century, kids are driving the stories. You really see, you know, children being these people who almost innately know how it is they themselves should become adults. And that says a lot about what Americans were worried about when it came to children. You know, sort of, you know, pre-1870s, pre-Second Industrial Revolution, people assumed that American adults were basically who they were as kids, right? That, like, a boy became a man almost despite who he was as a boy, right? That you really didn't need to guide kids into adulthood, that they sort of followed it. There were these natural guideposts that kids could just follow, and that your family was very important. By the turn of the 20th century, we've already seen the emergence of an array of child savers, psychologists, pediatricians, expert teachers, coaches, Boy Scout advisors, these sorts of people who are expected to help parents guide their children through very specific activities that will sort of marshal them through a mini evolutionary process. Recapitulation theory, G. Stanley Hall called it. You know, I think that, you know, the shift towards stories that see kids as the people who are driving, who know how to mature themselves at a time when that's actually not happening, when kids' freedom is actually dissipating, is telling, because I think it reveals that we were worried about whether or not we were messing up our kids. We were worried about whether we had made the right kind of decisions, whether or not the economy that was developing, this industrial and the consumer economy, was going to so change American values that kids wouldn't know how to become a good adult. And so if our fictional kids could figure it out by adopting the types of advice real-life adults were giving their own kids, then that was comforting on some level. But I think the interesting thing is, you know, by the turn of the 20th century, kids are not passive. You know, they're actively engaging this literature. And again, we talk about boundaries, and we think certain boundaries are natural. And one of those boundaries is there's an adulthood that's distinct from childhood, and that adult reading is different than child reading. I think that's completely wrong. And that kids read and interact with adults through stories much more, in a much more sophisticated fashion than we sometimes recognize.
In all of the work that each of you do, what are the limits of factual accuracy when it comes to storytelling? How close, how plausible does a story have to be in order for it to get purchased, either individually or in a society?
That's a good question. So in terms of our personal life narratives, I think it needs to have some basis in fact, right? Although we know memory research tells us that we don't remember things accurately. Even when we think we, like flashbulb memories, people tend to think that those are more accurate than our regular memories, and the research suggests that they're not. So, and then of course, as time passes, our accuracy decreases in terms of what we remember and how we remember it in terms of whether or not it's correct. So I think that of course it, in order to be incorporated into a life narrative, it needs to have some accuracy to it, at least in the mind of the individual who's constructing their life narrative. Mm-hmm. It needs to be accurate in that sense for it to have meaning, for it to have integration. So I say yes, but of course it's limited at mm-hmm. the personal level.
You know, people tend to remember stories and use stories according to, you know, as a historian, you know, when and where they're alive. You know, the set of stories that I looked at in my recent work involved the love triangle between a main character and two very different kinds of girls. And there was a lot of debate among the readers and the author about which one of the girls he should end up with. And ultimately picked one of the two women. And then when I was researching, I found this letter from the 1950s. So it's almost 60 years has passed. And there's this group of 50 and 60-year-old women in New York City who have a reading club. And they've written the publisher, Street & Smith, and say, look, we all read these stories that were boys' stories when we were girls because our brothers had them. And what we remember is this romance element. And so what we remember is important is that, like, he ended up with this girl. Her name was Enza something. But what was the name of the girl that upset him so much that he couldn't marry her? That's not actually what happened. So what these women were choosing to remember about the stories, you know, a half a lifetime later, and take the time to write a letter to the publishers to ask about, perhaps said more about, I don't know, their own, you know, their own unhappiness at that point in their life, you know, or what they chose to remember about that story, you know, as mothers themselves, perhaps. You know, by that point in life, they've got daughters and sons who are in their late teens and 20s and starting to form their own relationships. It's the 1950s. America's very concerned about creating these very heteronormative, very safe households to fight communism at home and abroad. So maybe that had something to do with what they were talking about.
And I think older texts tend to approach truth value from different directions. You know, a lot of spiritual writing, like saints' lives and things like that, would be in the category of told as true. You know, at this point, we cannot confirm that St. Edmund's severed head called to the searchers from the bushes for them to find it and bury it properly with the rest of his body after the Vikings left.
Well, that'll make a movie.
Right. But in the hagiographical Vita of St. Edmund, that is one of the key miracles that is a component of his canonization and is an important image of his relationship with the natural world. And perhaps an implicit repudiation of, there's a wolf involved, so there's a little bit of repudiation of earlier pagan belief, association of wolves with the battle dead in Germanic pagan religion. But and so it's told as true, it's believed, but it's not believed in the sense that anybody really thinks that they can go find the spot in the woods where it happened. But then you've got a lot of other stories that would be in sort of broader category that we would consider exempla, which are meant to have some truth value, capital T, but aren't necessarily meant to be something that ever really happened to a person. So there are lots of stories with a clear moral interpretation that the reader or hearer is expected to get from it, but there's never any expectation that it necessarily represents historically verifiable events, and in many cases they're historically impossible events, which is fine.
Marianne, do different tribes tell versions of the same story? And if the story ever involves the two tribes over some conflict or some common experience, how closely or how differently do they remember those events?
That's a good question. Yes. And it reminds me of Navajo and Apache stories. And Apache people used to be the same group, or if you ask them, they'll tell you that they were used to be the same tribe, although tribe's not really an accurate name for what the people would have called themselves. And if you ask an Apache person, they'll say, well, we couldn't hang with those Navajos because this, that, and the other. And the Navajo people will say, well, those Apaches were too violent, we couldn't stay with them. And so, they do have different versions of similar things. They might have the same, they might share similar territory using same animals or plants, but for different reasons. They might have a different relationship with, say, corn. How did corn come to be in your community? And they'll have a different story about how that came, or they'll have a different story about how the buffalo came to be so central in the lives of that group. There'll be slightly different interpretations of very similar types of stories. But in terms of truth-telling, you have to look at Native American stories like you look at the story of Adam and Eve in the Bible. Origin stories for Native people were different. Some people came out of the sky world, and they crossed over a bridge, and this one particular California group that I'm thinking of, they crossed over a sky bridge onto the land, and some of them fell into the water, and they became dolphins, and that's how the tribe is related to dolphin people. Hmm. And other people will have themselves tunneling out of the earth, and coming out of the earth like coming out of a womb, and that's how the people were born. Or other people, Zuni people look at themselves as being coming into the earth raw. And then as they mature into adulthood, they become fully cooked. So they believe that Coyote tried to make some people, but he really couldn't make any good people. Instead, they turn into dogs. So there's all sorts of these stories there. It's not correct to say that they're untrue. Okay, origin stories are not told as fairy tales. Okay, they're not just good stories to tell children to. They're told and they give landmarkers and they tell people where they came out of. So there's all sorts of elements within the story that you can actually go and document. You can actually go to that place and see where this events supposedly happened. There's a Bear Butte in Utah that actually has what look like indentions in it that are because of the structure of the rock, right? But there's this origin story to that butte that says a bear and another animal had a fight on that butte, and that the bear scratched the butte, and that's why it looks the way it does. When you say, are these stories true? Yes, they're true for those people in their homelands, and they're very important. And looking at them and talking about them as myth or lore is sometimes offensive to those people, as if you would say that Adam and Eve's story is myth or lore. So it's a very different way of thinking about truth telling.
We only have a minute left, so let's close today with a contemporary question. Give me a quick snapshot response. Do you think the current generation, the 21st century generation, the millennials, their reliance, their exposure to technology will change the way in which they will tell stories to their own kids?
Well, it's a very cool question, actually. So it's not something that I've thought about, but in terms of our own personal narratives and the fact that now we're tweeting, right? And what is it, 150 characters or less, is that what it is? Something like that?
With a picture of our lunch.
Right. So how does that, I mean, you can't do a whole lot of integration in that tiny little snapshot, right? You can't communicate a ton of meaning in a little Facebook post, but sort of maybe because they're being put forth more frequently, it's forming this sort of memory stack. We don't have journals anymore, but we can go back to our Facebook page or to our Twitter account and go through it and kind of figure out, you can see how you've changed over time, right, by scrolling through it, or how your life story is changing or evolving over time, which I think is pretty interesting. So I don't know if it's making it better or worse, but it is certainly making it different. So that would be my response to that.
Do y'all find your kids telling stories similar to the way you would have?
My kids read a lot, so they have not necessarily converted over to a completely digital take on literacy. But truthfully, the movement of text into electronic formats is not that different from the advent of writing in the first place or the advent of printing, both of which caused significant hand-wringing and hair-pulling over what are people's memories going to do. And to some extent, we know that memories did deteriorate. It used to be common, for example, for academics to memorize all of their textbooks. That there are known examples from the Middle Ages of scholars who had been exiled to the middle of nowhere still referring to their library because it was all in their head, which is a nice trick, and I wouldn't be able to do it. So we know that we've lost things over the way, that you know, our reliance on print would make some of our distant ancestors think of us as complete lightweights. But that kind of thing happens all the time, that we have been tweaking our way of saving words. And each advantage has relative advantages and disadvantages. Oral memory works quite well. And it's especially good at kind of pulling out the core essence of stories as the part that we remember, whereas print makes it a little easier to get caught up in minutia.
Yeah, and I think about the story that our daughter Annie wants to hear most often It's tell me about the day I was born, which is, you know, I think a fairly universal kind of question to want, you know, answered and want to hear about. And, you know, she wants to know about mom being in the living room and dad was getting lunch and they had to call out for the PA for dad to come running. And dad had to stop at the doors and there was a robot coming through dispensing medicine. And so dad joked that the robot war had started and get ready, here comes Terminator. But no, he couldn't fight the robot now because Annie was being born. You know, that's...
You gotta have your priorities.
Yes, you know. That's, you know, this is, you know, to her, this is... This
I'd
is,
see that movie,
this
too.
Is important. Yeah.
Silence of the story.
Yeah, and you know, and so, I mean, it strikes me that, you know, in some ways, it doesn't matter how we tell the story, what medium we tell the story in, there are certain universal qualities we will always want. I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts the other day, WTF with Mark Maron.
Your second favorite.
Sorry, second favorite now, he said to the dean. That, and he was interviewing Ron Perlman, who most people, you know, recognize.
I haven't gotten through it yet.
Okay.
So I'll tell it all.
Okay, I'll tell something, well, I'll tell something that won't hurt the content of the podcast. And Ron Perlman was talking about sort of his history in acting, and they were talking about, well, you know, how different is it now for kids to get into acting or to be good storytellers? And Perlman gave what I thought was this really kind of old school, get off my lawn kind of answer in one way, which he said, well, the edifice doesn't exist anymore. He said, you know, in the 60s and 70s, if you wanted to put on a play, like, you had to build it from hand. You had to convince somebody to finance it. You had to find the theater. You had to do all this stuff. And that was sort of it was an editing process. And so maybe you didn't get as many stories out there as you do today, where kids are using technology to tell stories or to make their own movies and put them online. But what you got was really good in a lot of ways. There was this sort of control on it. So he was ambivalent, and I thought, you know, and I thought that's sort of, you know, an interesting thing to keep in mind is technology has really opened up the doors for so many more people, musicians, actors, storytellers, political thinkers, to say much more. And it's gotten so much tougher to figure out who to listen to, and what it all means at the same time.
Many thanks to the panel today for our fascinating discussion on storytelling, Dr. Ashley Allen and Dr. Marianne Jacobs, Dr. Roger Ladd, and Dr. Ryan Anderson. Thank you for your time today. Thank you to all of you who are listening. And if you're enjoying it, pass it on to a friend. Check back next month for another podcast from the College of Arts and Sciences.
That's all the 30 Brave Minutes we have for you today. Thanks for listening, and thanks to our panel and all those who support the College of Arts and Sciences. If you want to join our list of contributors who help make events, student support, and programs like this one possible, please consider a contribution to the College of Arts and Sciences Dean's Fund. Mark your envelope, Dean's Fund, College of Arts and Sciences, UNC Pembroke, Hickory Hall, Pembroke, North Carolina, 28372. Or call the College of Arts and Sciences at 910-521-6198. You can also find us on the web. Today's podcast is produced by Dr. Richard Gay, theme music composed by Dr. Larry Arnold. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of the authorized representatives of the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. Appropriate legal action may be taken against any person, organization, or entity attempting to misrepresent, charge, or profit from the educational materials contained here. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of their discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, or positions of the University of North Carolina at Pembroke or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, or divisions. The channel, site, and all materials contained herein and otherwise affiliated were produced in good faith for educational purposes. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Brave.